From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's sports show, Only a Game. The designated hitter may be coming to the National League, and sooner than you might think. Ahead in Only a Game, why the Purist League may see a cadre of batter's box mercenaries as soon as 2017. Also, big trades and huge free agent deals dominate NFL offseason headlines. Why Manny Pacquiao's appeal in the Philippines goes way beyond boxing. And remembering the extraordinary sports writer and boxing novelist W.C. Hines. Also coming up, the Thunderbolt ski run electrifies a sleepy New England town in an old-timey sort of way.
When you ski the Thunderbolt, it's like going back in time. It truly is like going back in time. You hike up, you take your run, no ski patrol, no lights, no groom trails, no safety net. You're on the mountain, and that's it.
Stay tuned. On Tuesday at 4 p.m. Eastern, the rivers ran green with banknotes and loyalties melted away. The NFL's official free agency period began, and teams began negotiating with and signing players without contracts for the 2015 season and beyond. And if you believe that's precisely when the talks began and the deals were made, I have a Brooklyn NFL franchise to sell you. Act now. You get the bridge. Mike Tanier of Bleacher Report claims that before the official free agency period even began, he could write a free agent winners and losers column. Mike, why did you feel you could make that claim?
Well, not only could I do it, but just about anybody on the NFL could do it. In the past, there was a lot of what we call tampering, which was that teams would not wait until the official start of free agency to start negotiations. And eventually the NFL said, OK, we're going to put a 3-day window in where you could talk a little bit about it and begin discussions. Well, lo and behold, during that 3-day window, dozens of free agent signings were announced, and most of them turned out to be official in the long run. So those introductory talks wound up being actually the finalization of the negotiations, all the way down to the point where people felt confident to start tweeting and sending text messages to reporters that these were done deals.
Why were teams much more brazen this year about finalizing deals in that so-called open negotiation period? Weren't they afraid of accusations of tampering?
Nobody was doing it officially, and the NFL knew in the past that while no one would ever make any kind of announcement officially until 4 o'clock, the start of the day, that these things were going on. So it's not a lot of risk. You know, there was some talk. Damakong Su was the most famous of the deals. It was announced on Saturday afternoon, 2.5 days before anything was supposed to start. And it was a $114 million contract, so it's not like they were just dusting off something and handing it to him. You know, the NFL claims that they're investigating it and seeing if tampering was going on. What that's doing is making an announcement to everyone else, say, stop, or we'll say stop again. And if you jump the gun too much, we will come after you.
The prevailing wisdom used to be that the best way to build a roster was through the draft. But this week, the free agent money has flowed, and there were many trades involving top talent as well. What accounts for all this?
Well, there are a lot of teams that are still building through the draft and maybe acquiring that one player. You know, the wisdom is you build through the draft, but then a hot spot opens up where you might not have the guy you want. You need to get better fast because you're close to the Super Bowl, and there's a guy. The Seattle Seahawks is a great example. That team is built through the draft. They drafted Russell Wilson and Richard Sherman and made a very low-level trade years ago for Marshawn Lynch. They go to the Super Bowl. They come up one play short. So then they see an all-pro player available in trade, and they go after him in Jimmy Graham. A lot of teams are doing things the old-fashioned way, maybe grabbing a guy or two and then preparing for the draft.
Are we likely to see this sort of free agency bonanza henceforth, or will NFL teams eventually revert to the old method of building through the draft rather than through trades and these big free agent signings?
I think you're always going to see those handful of major free agents. I think you're going to see a bunch of teams who are always extremely active because they are trying a new philosophy out. I think you will see less of the premature contract announcements for a couple of reasons. One of them is there was one high-profile case, Frank Gore, who was going to go from the 49ers to the Eagles. He had second thoughts. And what you don't want, a realtor knows, you don't want somebody sitting around for 3 days thinking about it. Meanwhile, there's national news about what they're doing. That can get in their minds a little bit. I think agents are going to say, before we tweet this out, we want to make sure this guy has thought about it, that he's not getting talked about on Twitter when he hasn't signed a contract yet or has 4 days until he can do it. So we may see less of that crazy tampering, not because the NFL gets involved, but because it might not be the best business model.
You can find a link to Mike Tanier's column, What You Need to Know About NFL Free Agency, the Ultimate Preview or Review, at onlyagame.org. Mike, thanks very much.
Oh, always a pleasure. Take care.
Access to televised sporting events is at an all-time high, but so are cable and satellite prices. As Scott Graff reports, costs are going up again, leaving some subscribers to choose between spectatorship and savings.
5 years ago, CBS and Turner Broadcasting agreed to pay the NCAA nearly $11 billion for the broadcast rights for the men's basketball tournament over 14 years. It's the deal that puts games on CBS and channels like TBS and TNT. Among those who'll be watching again this year, Denny Moeller.
My wife says that if we don't have sports programming, we wouldn't have to have a TV. And I agree with her 100%.
Moeller lives in Eagle, Idaho. He's a retired college football coach and watches sports on TV year-round. This past Monday afternoon, Moeller sat in front of an HD TV in his living room and tuned in to the Big Ten Network. The regional sports channel out of Chicago is one of his mainstays.
There are so many good programs that give you more than just a score and give you just more than which coach is going to get fired. And they delve into the lives and of the players, and they delve into the lives of the coaches. And you just learn so much more.
For the dozens of hours he watches each month, the 73-year-old Moeller pays about $110. But he recently got word again that his DirecTV bill was going up this year. Customers of companies like Comcast, Time Warner Cable, and Cable One got similar news. The company's messaging was basically the same. Your bill is going up a few dollars a month because of sports. Derek Bain is research director at SNL Kagan, a company that studies the media industry.
The problem starts with the sports rights, which are, you know, the teams are jacking up prices sometimes 200, 300% when these big deals come up for renewal. So it's just this domino effect.
When it's time for leagues like the NFL, Major League Baseball, and NASCAR to sell their broadcast rights, networks like Fox, NBC, and ESPN will pay huge sums of money for long-term deals. Broadcasters recoup most of that through advertising, but they'll also charge cable and satellite companies more to carry their channels. Dan York is DirecTV's chief content officer. He says as a result, his company is forced to raise its prices by about 5% every year.
This dynamic is difficult for pay TV providers because they have no choice but to pass these costs along to consumers. And the rate of increase is unsustainable for customers, whether they're sports fans or not.
Analysts say big satellite and cable operators eat some of the increases, knowing they can't pass all of them on to consumers or risk attrition in subscriber numbers. SNL Kagan estimates operators have seen their profit margins cut nearly in half over the last 20 years. They're expected to continue shrinking, even as customers' bills go up. The constant increases are leading some people, like Joe Jezuski, to make changes.
The past couple years, I've really tried to cut out expenses from my life that were extraneous. And so this was one of them.
Jezuski lives in Boise, Idaho, and loves to watch football. But higher prices recently led him to rethink his satellite subscription. He now pays DirecTV $50 a month during football season and then shuts off his satellite service for 7 months a year. Dan Rayburn, an analyst with the firm Frost & Sullivan, says people like Jezuski, though, are the exception.
The bottom line is consumers are still willing to pay. They're not willing to cut cable because they want sports. Sports is the one thing that keeps them there. They complain about it. They don't want to pay it, but they continue to. They have no choice.
And Rayburn says hardcore fans who can't live without sports on their TVs should expect the trend of bigger satellite and cable bills to continue for years. For Only a Game, I'm Scott Graff in Boise, Idaho.
Like it or not, the DH is coming to the National League. That's the headline for a recent Sporting News column written by Jesse Spector, who says it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, and more than that, it's a matter of how. Jesse Spector joins me now. Jesse, the designated hitter rule was adopted by the American League back in 1973. Who wants the National League to adopt it now and why?
Well, I think the Players Association has wanted it for quite some time because the DH tends to be a higher paying job going to a veteran sort of hitter. Alex Rodriguez this year will be with the Yankees. He'll mostly be the DH. Mm-hmm. David Ortiz in Boston, a high paid veteran slugger DH. Baseball wants to see more offense, and getting the DH was part of a way that baseball addressed a downfall in offense back in the early 1970s. You had the year of the pitcher in 1968, and then a continuation of pitching dominance up through 1972, and Major League Baseball put the DH into the American League as a way to try to boost offense. So I think that that's part of the reason that it's no longer just the players who want it. It's the owners, and it makes logical sense for everybody to want to have it.
You mentioned Red Sox designated hitter David Ortiz, who is, of course, not only a designated hitter, but something of a larger-than-life figure in Boston and in the league in general. Maybe that's part of the reason why the National League would be just as happy to have some DHs, too.
Yeah, I think it is. I think that a National League team can't really commit to getting a guy like that. A few years ago, the Dodgers brought in Jim Thome, a similar type of hitter, and a guy who wound up hitting 500 home runs in his career. Pretty good bet that he's going to be in the Hall of Fame eventually. But the Dodgers were barely able to use him because he was just a bench player for them. He was a guy that they could use as a pinch hitter every now and then. And the Phillies are in this situation with Ryan Howard, too. He'd be a lot more valuable as a trade piece if they could trade him to teams in the National League. So it cuts the Phillies' trade market for a guy like that in half when they're trying to rebuild. So certainly a team like that, it would benefit them if the National League had the designated hitter, and that's another way that it becomes beneficial to everybody.
There are probably some purists who feel that the way to address the inconsistency between the leagues is to eliminate the DH, never mind that they have thrived in the American League since 1973. Is there an answer for them?
It's not going to happen. How would the Red Sox feel about that? How would they feel if you said, yeah, we're going to take away the position that your most beloved and popular player plays, and we're going to make him play first base all the time? Oh, but by the way, you already have a first baseman, so you're going to have to find a way to get rid of him or do something else. And the Players Association would never go for that either. You'd be eliminating these high-paying jobs for veteran players. And it's not a smart business decision by the league either, because you're shortening the careers of stars, guys that you can market and build the game around.
You end your piece by stating that you will see designated hitters in National League parks sooner than later. Any guess as to how soon?
Well, I think that you could see it as soon as the next collective bargaining agreement. They're going to start talks next winter because the CBA is coming up. So I would not be at all surprised to see it in a couple of years. It could be the CBA after that, but I think that it will not just be in our children's lifetimes, but you know, it's not something like that. I think it'll be soon. It'll be in our parents' lifetimes.
You can find a link to Jesse Spector's Sporting News column, Like It or Not, the DH is Coming to the National League, at onlyagame.org. Jesse, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
After years of speculation and anticipation, boxers Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao have agreed to fight on May the 2nd in Las Vegas. While the American, Mayweather, falls short of celebrity status outside boxing circles in the U.S., Manny Pacquiao's star long ago ascended beyond boxing in his home country of the Philippines. Grantland editor Rafe Bartholomew lived in the Philippines from 2005 to 2008. Rafe, soon after your arrival there, you witnessed the country's devotion to Manny Pacquiao firsthand. Tell me a little bit about that.
You know, I went there on a Fulbright research grant to work on a book about the history of basketball there. And one morning, it was after one of Manny Pacquiao's fights. And I went to the municipal court, and the sort of entire staff of the local municipal hall was standing there, hands held, heads bowed in prayer, with one person on a megaphone leading a prayer saying, you know, thank you, Lord, for the victory of Manny Pacquiao. He brought great honor to the Philippines, and we wish him continued success. And this was 10 years ago already.
You have written that Pacquiao's fight is charged with meaning for the country every time he steps into the ring. What baggage does he carry beyond the imperative to keep winning?
Manny has sort of almost single-handedly elevated the profile of the Philippines on an international stage, which is sort of a strange thing to think about, given it's a nation of over 100 million people now. And even though some of the sort of elite circles in the Philippines sort of quibble over whether or not they want an athlete representing them on such an international level, he's beloved really by people who don't know anything about the Philippines because he puts such a humble, friendly face on the country as a sportsman.
Well, let's talk about some of the particulars. Pacquiao is also an actor and a singer. He owns a team in the Philippine Basketball Association's Development League. He's suited up for a different team that he sometimes coaches. He's currently in his second term as a congressman in the Philippine House of Representatives. Can he possibly do all of these things well?
No, I don't think that he expects to do all of them well, and few Filipinos do either. I mean, there's a long history of once you become a celebrity in the Philippines, then you start sort of like seeping out into the other kinds of celebrity. So there are other famous basketball players in the Philippines who have recorded their own albums, and none of them can sing, but it's just sort of like, I'm famous, I might as well make an album, I might as well have a sitcom. And so I think the two areas where Pacquiao is earnestly trying to succeed are boxing, of course, and he's honestly trying to be a good politician. Now, he has a pretty bad record of attendance in Congress, but that's sort of understood because the rest of the House wants him to train for his fights and continue winning.
Pacquiao is 36. Floyd Mayweather is 38. Their bout is being billed as the fight of the century. No surprise there. Lots of fights are billed that way. But it's tempting to suggest that it would have been a better fight if they'd met a little earlier in the century, isn't it?
Well, that's what everyone sort of feels like. And it was very, very disappointing in 2009 when the negotiations first fell through. And then every other time they fell through after that. And while I think most people who follow boxing closely would agree that they've slipped from their absolute athletic peaks at you know, in their late 30s, that's not a surprise. They're still considered the number one and number two best fighters in the sport.
Manny Pacquiao is the underdog in this fight with Floyd Mayweather. Do you get the sense that Filipinos are happy that this fight is happening, or do they seem to you worried that Pacquiao's image may take a hit?
Oh, no. I mean, I think the country, and I've, you know, I read the news and follow it pretty closely over there, is pretty elated that this fight is finally happening. I mean, aside from being, you know, Filipino and Manny Pacquiao fans, they're, you know, boxing fans too. And they've been, and like everyone else, have been waiting for this fight to happen. And Filipinos, I think, have a lot more confidence in Pacquiao's chances in this fight than, say, the average American boxing fan or sports fan does. When you're rooting from a place of national pride, it's very easy to say, oh, our guy is tougher, he's stronger, he'll bring the fight. So we're not afraid at all.
Rafe Bartholomew is an editor for Grantland. Rafe, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot, Bill.
On the same week as the latest fight of the century was announced, a new documentary featuring combatants in past fights of the century was released. Among those featured in Champs is Mike Tyson, who speaks about his Brooklyn origins.
The worst characteristic you could think of black life is where I stem from. A lot of drugs, tons of violence. My parents, old women, they was in the sex industry and stuff, and that's what they did. We weren't safe in the house. We were always vulnerable. A lot of men sleep with my sister, beat me.
Director Burt Marcus chronicles Tyson's career, as well as those of boxing champions Bernard Hopkins and Evander Holyfield. Burt Marcus, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Numbers of the fighters, trainers, and writers featured in Champs establish early and often that historically, boxing has offered men with almost nothing an opportunity to improve their circumstances. Did that truism help you choose which boxers to feature in the film?
I think absolutely. The irony that's inherent in the sport of boxing was initially what drew me, but these men in particular, escaping such a savage life through a savage profession, was the ultimate paradox and why I found them in particular to be a perfect vehicle to take us through.
I think the most compelling figure in the film is Bernard Hopkins. In one segment, he talks about his reputation when he was sentenced to 18 years in prison at the age of only 17.
After getting a few fights, I built a reputation on the block like I was building on the streets. I was known, don't fight me, you gotta stab me. Things going through my head was that I'll be dead before I'm 18, or I'll be in prison all my life, or that I'll be nothing.
Bernard Hopkins rediscovered boxing in prison, and he was released in 1988. He became the IBF middleweight champion in 1993. How did he manage to avoid the fate that he'd anticipated?
I think Bernard is just one of those guys with the real will to succeed in life. And Bernard in particular really takes you through that journey of what it takes to be a champion outside of the ring as well as inside, and how to actually have a successful, productive life when his boxing career comes to an end. He's still boxing, but he plays such an integral role in shaping young amateur boxers and helping people be surrounded by the proper people and making sure every single person that enters the sport has the proper knowledge, education, and team and support to be successful after their career.
Hopkins said at one point that he learned to think of prison as a business. Talk about what he meant by that.
I think what he means is that in America, especially, the prison system has just gotten out of control. You know, the prison population has quadrupled since 1980. I mean, in the film, we even talk about the fact that 5% of the world's population is made up of Americans, but we make 25% of the world's prison population. And that's something I think that a lot of boxers who have been in and out of the system, especially someone like Bernard, can attest to and hopefully bring a lot of these issues to the forefront.
Mike Tyson's excesses, of course, are well known, as is his criminal history. But there's a moment in the film that may surprise even people who think they know all about Mike Tyson. It comes apparently when he's responding to the assertion that being the heavyweight champion can do strange things to your head.
Just think, anybody in this planet, what, 6 billion people? 6 billion, right? Anybody in this planet, you could beat them in a fair fight. So you tell me how that feeds your ego.
As you were making the film, did you begin to find Mike Tyson a sympathetic figure?
Yeah, I mean, I've known Mike for many years, and I've always been fascinated with Mike. A lot of different sides to him. I was really surprised by his humility, to be honest. He's been to the top of the top and to the bottom of the bottom, and he can really open himself up.
Have Tyson, Holyfield, or Hopkins let you know what their thoughts are on Champs?
I think they feel like we did get it right. They feel like this is an important film that goes way beyond boxing. You know, it's a human story. It's about where we are in America. I think it's a microcosm for a much bigger, you know, subject matter, and that's why it was a great vehicle for us.
Bert Marcus is the director of Champs in theaters this weekend. Bert, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, thanks so much. It was great.
I first met W.C. Hinds, who asked me to call him Bill, a little over 60 years after he was nearly flattened by a truck, the side of which featured a big picture of him. The words beside the picture read, W.C. Hinds, read his human interest stories on sports daily in the Sun. Buy it today. The driver of the truck was apparently in a hurry to deliver copies of the New York Sun to the places where people could buy it to read the work of W.C. Hinds, as the banner on the truck urged them to do. Hinds, agile enough in those days, jumped back onto the curb from the street into which the truck had careened as Bill had started across it. W.C. Hinds sold newspapers. Damon Runyon was a fan of his work. So was Ernest Hemingway, Death of a Racehorse, which Bill wrote on Deadline on July 27, 1949, has been celebrated as the best column ever published in a sports section. It tells the story of the first and last race of Airlift, son of bold venture, full brother of assault, as promising a horse as ever stepped onto a racetrack. Airlift leaves the gate and is running fifth, then fourth, then third, but as he seems about to demonstrate his class and take the lead, Airlift breaks his leg. After a hurried call to the owner, the horse is put down. The final two paragraphs of the column provide the end of the story.
They moved the curious back, the rain falling faster now, and they moved the colt over, close to a pile of loose bricks. Gilman had the halter, and Catlett had the gun, shaped like a bell with the handle at the top. This bell he placed, the crowd silent, on the colt's forehead, just between the eyes. The colt stood still, and then Catlett, with the hammer in his hand, struck the handle of the bell. There was a short, sharp sound, and the colt toppled onto his left side, his eyes staring, his legs straight out, the free legs quivering. "Ah," someone said. That was all they said. They worked quickly, the two vets removing the broken bones as evidence for the insurance company, the crowd silently watching. Then the heavens opened, the rain pouring down, the lightning flashing, and they rushed for the cover of the stables. Leaving alone on his side, near the pile of bricks, the rain running off his hide, dead an hour and a quarter after his first start, Airlift, son of bold venture, full brother of assault.
2 years later, Hines wrote Brownsville Bum. Jimmy Breslin has said this profile of an otherwise forgettable fighter called Bummy Davis, which Bill wrote for True, is the best sports story ever to appear in a magazine. When I spoke with him at his home in Vermont in 2000, I asked Bill Hines to read the first paragraph.
It's a funny thing about people. People will hate a guy all his life for what he is. But the minute he dies for it, they make him out a hero, and they go around saying that maybe he wasn't such a bad guy after all, because he sure was willing to go the distance for whatever he believed in or whatever he was.
And this is, of course, Bummy. Not a spectacularly admirable man until he had his one chance to do something exceptionally admirable.
Yeah. And the second paragraph here says, that's the way it was with Bummy Davis. The night Bummy fought Fritzy Zivic in the garden and Zivic started giving him the business and Bummy hit Zivic low maybe 30 times and kicked the referee, they wanted to hang him for it. The night those four guys came into Duty's bar and tried to do the same thing only with rods, Bummy went nuts again. He flattened the first one, and then they shot him. And when everybody read of it and how Bummy fought guns with only his left hook and died lying in the rain in front of the place, they all said he was really something, and you sure had to give him credit at that.
Even toward the end of his life, which came in 2008 when he was 93, Bill's sense of humor was sharp. We first met over the phone in 1999 when I interviewed him about the anthology Best American Sports Writing of the Century. Later, when we spoke about a collection of writing about boxing, which he had edited, I was curious about the inclusion of one particular magazine story in that collection. It was titled How It Feels to Be the Champ. The byline is Rocky Marciano, and Rocky maintains that being heavyweight champion of the world isn't quite what he thought it would be.
You mentioned in the notes before that piece that Marciano had some help with it,
yeah.
But it's instructive, I think, nevertheless. Did you hesitate to use it because it was ghostwritten?
No, because I was the ghostwriter.
After he'd been a correspondent overseas during World War II, W.C. Hines returned to New York to frequent gyms, talk with trainers and boxers, and eventually to write a novel set in the sport titled The Professional. Ernest Hemingway cabled from Florida to say it was the best novel about a fighter he'd ever read. W.C. Hines was eventually inducted into the Boxing Hall of Fame, but he wrote about horse racing, too, and baseball and most of the other games people play, including roller derby. He has been credited with influencing the work of David Halberstam, among many others. He was a thoughtful reader, generous in his responses. I know this firsthand. Shortly after I first visited him in Vermont, he expressed interest in my work. I sent him a copy of the first collection of my radio and magazine pieces published by a small press on Cape Cod. And when I told Bill that the publisher had said that if I didn't drive out to the storage unit on the Cape where he'd been keeping 100 or so of the books, he was going to shred them. Bill was outraged. He can't do that, he said. It's a good book. In everything W.C. Hines wrote, there is evidence that he listened carefully and saw pretty much everything there was to see. Here are the final few paragraphs of a column Hines wrote in October of 1949 after a lopsided college football game in the Yale Bowl.
In the parking areas an hour after the game, the cars still stood, congested. On some, the luggage racks were still open, and the people stood around them. The evening sun starting to darken now, the people still laughing, the glasses again in their hands. The headlights were on by the time the last of the cars crowded out. In the west, the dark clouds were starting to open, the sky to glow a little, the first star to show. The red tail lights strung as far as you could see, the cars moving in a great company, the dead leaves swirling behind the cars, dancing in the headlights of the ones behind. Those who had heard the rumor had heard it right. The football season had, indeed, started.
Bill Hines pasted his columns into a scrapbook, and under that particular column he had written in light pencil, good description, at end. After some of the other columns, he'd written simply, good. I don't know if Bill ever intended for anyone to see those penciled notes, but I saw them because about 5 years after Bill died, his daughter Gail asked me to help edit a collection of her father's best columns, profiles, and magazine pieces set in sports. Gail and the editors at Library of America also wanted me to write the introduction for the book, which was to be titled The Top of His Game, The Best Sports Writing of W.C. Hines. The book officially came out on Tuesday, but I had some advance copies, and I sent them to some friends. I sent them with pride and concern. pride that my name appeared on the cover right under W.C. Hines, and concern that nothing I had written to introduce this collection of his work could be adequate to that responsibility. W.C. Hines was an extraordinary writer whose work is characterized by care, integrity, and the same quiet sense of humor that so delighted me almost 15 years ago when I was fortunate enough to make his acquaintance and become his friend. It is enormously gratifying to have had a small part in what I hope will turn out to be the wider recognition of the excellence of the writing W.C. Hines did. And it is gratifying as well to have heard recently from Bill's daughter Gail, who found the introduction satisfactory and wrote, "I know Dad would be extremely pleased that it was you who took on the job." For a discussion of the week's news, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce, who's begun the grueling road trip that will take him to various basketball venues over the next few weeks. Hello, Charlie.
Well, it's not Lewis and Clark. I have room service and stuff.
Yeah, probably motorized vehicles as well. The NCAA men's basketball tournament, which will begin on Tuesday, will see an estimated 40 million people filling out brackets with a projected $2 billion wagered in pools. So, would it be an exaggeration to say that the business of college basketball is booming?
Well, both the overground and underground economies certainly are. This is once again one of the either unintended consequences or unintended benefits of the internet has made this kind of gambling a lot easier. In a lot of ways, the NCAA Division I men's basketball tournament is what this country has for a World Cup.
By one estimation, men's NCAA basketball teams generated $1.6 billion in revenue last year. And according to a publication called Nerd Wallet, if we were to apply the NBA's revenue-sharing model, the average player at a top 25 school would be worth nearly $488,000. That sound about right to you?
It sounds about right to me. And of course, this is the great issue on which the existing paradigm of college sports is tottering right on the brink of falling down and breaking into a zillion pieces. The inequity has grown so obviously grotesque that it's not supportable.
Before we move on from basketball, Charlie, would you like to offer only a game's congratulations to a team that will enter the dance undefeated?
This will be the third time since 1976 that this has happened. I think Kentucky has a better shot at actually ending the season without a loss than Vegas did in 1991.
Yeah, but that's the wrong team. I'm thinking about
the Princeton
women.
Oh, you're thinking about the Princeton women.
Yeah.
I hope Princeton can make a run because it would be a great, great story. But I'm still seeing, you know, Connecticut and Duke and North Carolina and Notre Dame and the rest of the A-list out there. So, yes, I would hope that Princeton would be able to make a serious run because, as I said, it would be a glorious story.
Well, it would be. And if they do manage to even win a game, they would be the first Ivy League women's team to win a tournament game since Harvard upset number one Stanford in 1998.
Yeah, this would be also a good thing. I'm wondering if alum Bill Bradley, who was on the last Princeton team to make the Final Four, will be there.
After a string of accusations of match-fixing in the lower ranks of pro tennis, Slate this week tried to get a handle on what's going on. Their experts suggested that multiple matches a week involving players making as little as $500 per tournament were being influenced by gamblers. I'm not surprised to learn that this is going on in places like Ukraine, but matches in Dallas seem to be suspect as well. Are you shocked?
I am absolutely shocked. Of course, there's a long and storied history of this kind of thing and this kind of barely concealed corruption. It goes back to the days when they were trying to maintain the amateur model in tennis, and I suspect it's been going on sub rosa ever since.
Gamblers are apparently using Facebook messages to contact tennis players who might be financially vulnerable. So just another way in which social media is ruining the world.
What are they doing? Tracking whether among these people's likes are, you know, two for one night at Olive Garden or something? Is there a like button for bribes?
This seems to me consistent with fixes in other sports. I mean, the Kentucky Derby is not as likely to be rigged as, oh, say, a midweek $1,500 claimer at Humpty Dumpty Downs in East Nowhere, right?
I think that's the case. I mean, I don't know how people finally tumbled to this unless somebody was dissatisfied with their payout. I think this is exactly the kind of thing that happens where people aren't watching on ESPN.
Speaking of those who would skirt the regulations in one way or another, Brent Sass, an accomplished sled dog racer, has been disqualified at the Iditarod, but he wants his fans to know, quote, "I was not cheating in any way, shape, or form. I was just stupid. How did his stupidity manifest itself?
The theme of this week's segment is obviously the baleful influence of modern technology on competitive sports. This guy was using his iPad Touch.
Yeah, and he didn't even know it was against the rules, you know.
What advantage does he get?
Oh, GPS, find the shortcuts.
Well, that's just cheating itself, isn't it? I mean, if you find a shortcut in the Iditarod.
Chicago White Sox broadcaster Ken Harrelson said this week that he thinks it might be the Cubs and the White Sox in the World Series this time around. This is just exactly the sort of dream for which spring training was created, right?
Obviously, he has a vested interest in saying that about the White Sox, but the Cubs are expected to, you know, with the arrival of Joe Maddon and apparently a loaded farm system, the Cubs are you know, expected, you know, to start making a move now under Theo Epstein.
And finally, Charlie, there have been complaints about unruly spectators at golf tournaments recently, but controversy erupted this week over a well-behaved but unwelcome fan at a women's tournament at Mayaca Pines Golf Club in Englewood, Florida. You want to describe that visitor for us?
A big old par five alligator, Bill. This was a Godzilla gator. I can't drive the ball the length of this alligator. I really can't. This thing is huge.
It looks like he crawled out of the prehistoric past, doesn't he?
We have ground rules and we have winter rules, and now we have large carnivore rules in golf. My score could really drop, by the way.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland. Charlie, thanks very much.
Thanks, Bill.
Lance Armstrong and the sport he once ruled were back in the news this week, welcome as snakes on a bike. A report issued on Sunday by a commission appointed by the International Cycling Union, known as UCI, blamed much of what had gone so dramatically wrong with cycling on the UCI itself. As the report put it, for a long time the main focus of UCI leadership was on the growth of the sport worldwide, and its priority was to protect the sport's reputation. I'll pause now for those who wish to giggle at the suggestion that the sport had a reputation to protect. Anyway, the ideas that cycling's governing body saw value in tying its fate to the enormous popularity and celebrity Armstrong had achieved by defeating the world's best cyclists, having previously defeated cancer. The UCI can't necessarily be faulted for that. The major sports leagues do the same thing, building their marketing efforts on the achievements and personas of their most attractive individuals. But when one of those individuals turns out to be a serial liar, willing to ruin any number of people in the effort to sustain the image he and his handlers have manufactured, with the assistance of the sport's governing body, the effort is probably doomed to crash into embarrassment, lawsuits, and bad TV interviews. The commission's report indicts not only Armstrong, but the sport itself, reviewing cycling's history of doping, though at this point it's hard to imagine who might feel another such review is necessary, many of the juiced cyclists having written books about their transfusions and other transgressions. Anyway, for folks who haven't heard enough tales of frozen blood, dirty doctors, and what the New York Times characterizes as riders' circulatory systems that had been turned into smuggling devices, there's all that and more. The hope among clean competitors and fans of the sport is that someday one of these exercises in investigation will move some distance toward the reclamation of cycling. That's not happening with the report issued on Sunday, for although it concludes that, quote, there was a general feeling that these days riders can at least be competitive while riding clean, it also warns that, quote, the commission did not hear from anyone credible in the sport who would give cycling a clean bill of health in the context of doping today. Much as he might wish it were otherwise, Lance Armstrong's legacy lives on. Adams is a town of less than 9,000 in the Berkshire Mountains of western Massachusetts. It lacks the art galleries, museums, and antique stores that attract visitors to surrounding towns, but Adams is banking on the reemergence of a sport that's kept the town on the map for more than 80 years. Only a Game's Karen Given has the story.
I give them everything, my boots, my skis, everything. They got everything here.
93-year-old Stephen Nowicki skied the Thunderbolt when he was a kid. Now he waits, perched on a walker chair at the front of the Thunderbolt Ski Museum, a recently installed exhibit in the shadow of Mount Greylock.
Matter of fact, it's on the brand new shoes. I never wore them after. The war come and that was it.
Visitors can touch the sealskins Nowicki and his friends attached to the bottom of their skis to climb the mountain, and they can feel the dull edges on the thick wooden skis they use to come back down. A mannequin in the corner wears Nowicki's favorite sweater, Long before his body became stooped and frail, someone snapped a picture of him wearing it.
Oh, yeah, that was my favorite.
In the fall of 1939, the Civilian Conservation Corps cut the Thunderbolt ski run into the eastern face of Mount Greylock, the highest peak in Massachusetts. The Class A racing trail was soon attracting city dwellers by the thousands.
The ski train has become an American institution, and winter play spots throughout the country are settings for the happy antics of weekend fugitives from the city pavement gang.
That's when the trains used to run here. Then the farmers would come with the sleighs and the horses and bring them up there. Oh, yeah. Oh, they'd be thousands of people. Every race, yep.
The Thunderbolt also attracted championship skiers, Olympians from places like Harvard and Yale. The speed records from that era still stand. As for the men Nowicki skied with.
Nope, pretty well gone now. I'm beating them all.
Many of Adam's young ski champions served in the 10th Mountain Division during World War II. Stephen Nowicki had always wanted to fly, so he piloted B-24 Liberators, a plane sometimes called the Flying Coffin. The championship skiers of the Thunderbolt might have been forgotten if not for high school biology teacher, amateur documentarian, and history buff Blair Mahar.
Mahar, M-A-H-A-R.
But Mahar says it wasn't World War II that spelled the end of the races on the Thunderbolt. It was a force far less menacing.
This is Sun Valley, fringed by the picturesque peaks of the Sawtooth Mountains.
In 1936, the world's first chairlifts were installed at Sun Valley in Idaho. Before long, ski resorts from Tahoe to the Alps offered an easier way to get to the top.
A maximum of downhill skiing with a minimum of effort.
You know, nobody wanted to walk up a mountain when you could ride up a mountain.
Mahar says of the four New England Class A trails cut by the CCC in the 1930s, the Thunderbolt is the only one that never became part of a major ski area. A proposal to build a tramway to the summit was defeated in 1941. But over the decades, all attempts to develop the Thunderbolt failed.
When you ski the Thunderbolt, it's like going back in time. It truly is like going back in time. You hike up, you take your run, no ski patrol, no lights, no groom trails, no safety net. You're on the mountain, and that's it.
The last major championship on the Thunderbolt was held in 1948. Nearly 60 years later, Mahar produced a documentary called Purple Mountain Majesty. By then, locals and backcountry enthusiasts were shushing down a trail overgrown by brambles and sticker bushes. The movie reminded the people of Adams of the town's great skiing history, and it made them sad to see the course in such disrepair. As the 75th anniversary of the first championship race on the Thunderbolt approached, locals decided to do something about it.
Really, the trail had grown in. Wasn't really anybody up there doing much. And then we began cutting it and kind of reclaiming it and, yeah, reclaiming that race.
I was born ready.
Blair Mahar and his friends didn't just bring back the Thunderbolt. They brought back the races. So on a bright, sunny Saturday that seemed much warmer than its 10-degree forecast, Stephen Nowicki has come to the base of the trail to send off a new generation of ski racers on the 80th anniversary Thunderbolt ski race.
If you look straight over here, Steve Nowicki.
Many of the 100 racers are wearing brightly colored spandex suits. Their skis and snowboards are designed with the latest technology. A small white drone hovers overhead, ready to take video of the mass start. It's an oddly modern scene for a bunch of racers getting ready to step back in time.
3, 2, and they're off!
Today's race is being run randonnée style, also called ski mountaineering, ski-mo, and rando. Racers start at the bottom and are timed on both the uphill and the downhill. Today's course loops the Thunderbolt twice. The sport is big in Europe, but most American ski resorts frown on the practice. I'm not a skier, so I find an easier way to reach the top of Mount Greylock. Before long, racers start arriving at the summit in twos and threes. They rip off their climbing skins, made of nylon and mohair, not seal, and shove them inside their racing suits. Before they can even catch their breath, it's time to head back down.
Racer number 121, Patrick Rondo, just about to leave the summit.
Some people are, you know, sick of standing in a lift line, freezing their butt off on a ski lift when you can stay as warm as you want on the way up and hopefully go ski some nice soft snow.
That's Jeremy Arnold, the winner of today's race. It took him a little less than an hour to climb the nearly 2-mile trail and about 6 minutes to ski back down. In Stephen Nowicki's day, racers weren't timed on their way to the summit. They rested at the top and raced down one by one. Nowicki's best finish was just over 3 minutes. At Mount Greylock, skiing up is the way it's always been. And racer Bob Yates says no one here has forgotten that.
Yeah, I have a lot of respect for people that came before you, you know, and skied back in the day before, you know, and pioneered it in big wooden skis. And, you know, these are just a cheating compared to what those guys were on. They were the real deal, you know. We're just running around in bright nylon, you know.
After the race, skiers and locals gather for Thunderfest, an event inspired by the return of racing to Adams. There's even a local brewery pouring pints of Thunderbolt IPA. Stephen Nowicki uses his walker to navigate a large patch of ice in front of the stage. He hands medals to the top finishers. The crowd cheers like he's a rock star.
Stephen Nowicki!
After 4 decades of relative obscurity, the Thunderbolt is once again bringing visitors to Adams. Not by the thousands, at least not yet. But Mahar says the event is growing.
So nobody wanted to walk up a mountain to ski down, but people want to do that today.
Yeah, I think people want to walk up a mountain and ski back down today to get away from long lift lines and lift ticket prices that are going through the roof to come to the Thunderbolt. It's free. It truly is like going back in time, and I think people are seeking that out more and more.
Mount Greylock is a state reservation, and the Thunderbolt is now protected from development. The people of Adams say that's just the way they like it. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our assistant producer is Martin Kessler. Our technical director is James Trout. And our intern is Keely Flanagan. We had help this week from Shannon Dooling and Alex Ashlock. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from Heather Linscott, who describes the scene skiers can expect when ascending Mount Greylock.
The snow gets thicker. It's crystallized on the branches. It's just beautiful. Especially today, on a bluebird day like today.
Only a skier could put such a positive ornithological spin on the lousiest winter in recent memory. Enough with the snow! I'm Bill Littlefield. I'll be back next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thank you for listening.